Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
So this is what's going on. Do you guys want to come in? Do you want to come on in? Come on in, little friends. Do you even know what's going on? Oh yeah, okay. So Richard went to the bookstore. Okay, so that's where we're at. So the mayor came to introduce Richard tonight, but the mayor had to go because Richard's at the bookstore and he's on his way to the library. And so I said to the mayor, well, you probably have some place you have to go. And he said, yes, here are my remarks. So I'm going to read them. What the heck? We got some time. We got nothing to do. I will say, if I had known that I was going to be in front of an audience tonight, I would have changed clothes. Okay. Picture the mayor. I'm in a striped suit, pink tie. Good evening, readers. We are pleased to have, you know, why not get this done now? And then I'll introduce him, we'll get everything out of the way, and then he'll just walk in and go to work, right? Okay, good. We are pleased, I've not read this before. We are pleased to have author Richard Ford with us tonight to speak about his new book, Let Me Be Frank With You. However, have you noticed that he always says that? However, before I hand over the microphone, let me talk with you briefly about three things that are very important to me, the mayor. It is important that all parents read to their children every day. I don't actually think that's true. My parents never once read to me. I turned out just fine. There are a lot of studies that say, this isn't in the mayor's remarks, there are a lot of studies that say that the important thing is not reading to your children. The important thing is that your children see you reading. And that they know that when you're reading, it's like you're having a conversation with another adult. I remember so well when I was 8 years old. We got time to kill. I'm just spinning this out. When I was 8 years old, my father was reading The Godfather. And my parents were divorced, and I didn't get to see my father very often. But he was only reading The Godfather, and he kept telling us to go away. And he was not reading us The Three Pigs. And then the morning that we got up and he said, they cut the horse's head off and put it in the bed. And that was made much more of an impression, I think, than if Dad had read me a book. Okay, number two, we need to encourage adults who struggle with reading who struggle with English to reach out for help, use our community's resources, and learn to read. That I am completely down with. And I'm down with you reading to your kids, too. Just also tell them to go away so you can read. And finally, every single resident of Nashville should have a library card and use our library's great resources. That's true, but if you have money, you should come to Parnassus and buy your books. Just, you shouldn't be tying up that copy of The Goldfinch that somebody who needs to check out that copy of The Goldfinch, you know, you should just buy yours if you can. If you can't, check it out. No judgment. Obviously, each of you already loves reading and values literacy in your life. However, I am asking you to become more active ambassadors of literacy. You can read to kids in the community. That's true. That's a very good idea. You can volunteer to tutor adults learning to read. You can do that. They know about all of that at the library here. You can donate books to young people who don't have books in their own home. Can we do that through the library? How can we do that? We can, oh, book them. Thank you very much. Okay. You can volunteer. Can you just imagine the mayor reading this and be like, mayor, how can we get those books to the kids? Can we bring them by your house? What? Wait, tell me. Imagination Library? Is that the Dolly Parton thing? But can we donate books to Imagination Library? No, we just applaud them. We can get people to apply and sign up for Imagination Library, but not people who are sending their kids to Ensworth. That seems so strange to me that like people with a lot of money can also get free books from Imagination Library. Okay, well, that's right. Back to the mayor. You can volunteer with the library or with other community organizations that are focused on reading. We would love to have your help in whatever way is right for you. That's absolutely true. We are so fortunate to have our Nashville Public Library, which is really an astonishing library, a great organization not just of buildings and books, but also of people, ideas, and community. I was telling Elise just moments ago that I was in Tulsa this weekend. I did their library gala. I've just come back from Tulsa, and they're doing a 3-year renovation on their public library in Tulsa, and their library right now is in a Safeway. It's unbelievable. Circa 1960, you remember Safeway in the 60s? You know, it's huge, huge, with giant ceilings and big swinging electric doors and a parking lot that goes all the way around, and it's called a librarium, and that's where they had their gala. Our library continues to grow, it's not in a safe way, and to grow Nashville as a city of readers. Tonight, please join me in thanking the library, along with the Library Foundation, Parnassus Books, and Humanities Tennessee, for their good work in bringing Richard Ford and so many other modern leaders of the written word and culture to Nashville. We're also thankful for and respectful of the great authors who share their words and ideas with us here. And we hope, are you guys getting bored? Are you sort of tuning out a little bit? And we hope and believe that these authors are also thankful for and respectful of the warm, intelligent reception. He always says that. And, you know, sometimes when you go to Cleveland to give one of these talks, you're not so thankful. You just kind of want to go home. Or you don't even know what city you're in. So while I hope that Richard Ford is thankful and respectful, if he's not, we will love him just the same. Our guest tonight is author Richard Ford, who may well be in the parking lot this very moment. Ford is the author of the Frank Bascom novels, which include The Sports Writer and its sequels, Independence Day, the first novel to win both the Pulitzer Prize and the Penn Faulkner Award, and The Lay of the Land. Tommy, what was your favorite of the four? Sports Writer, the first one, okay. In his latest book, Let Me Be Frank With You, oh, there he is, okay, good. Ford reinvents, I'm just dragging this out the basket. Okay, all right, he lives in Booth Bay, Maine with his wife, Christina Ford. And I want to say, I was just giving the mayor's introduction for you. I just want to say that this is my favorite Richard Ford book, and it's really, really beautiful. It's beautiful writing. All of Richard's books have beautiful writing in them, but this book really taught me something. This book really, really made me think about my life and about the world I live in. I was extremely moved by it. Ladies and gentlemen, my friend who wish he had maybe 2 minutes to himself, but he doesn't, Richard Ford.
Well, it's all downhill after that. Thank you all for waiting. I apologize to you for being late. Never let anybody in New York tell you to get anywhere in Nashville. It's a great treat to be in Nashville, and it's a great treat to do anything with Anne and with Parnassus Books, and it's particularly nice to do something for the library. I'm a child of the library in the Eudora Welty Library now in Jackson, Mississippi, where my mother used to routinely dump me because it was the only place in town that was air-conditioned, even in the 50s, so she could safely, well, she thought safely, leave me there. I'm going to move this around a little bit so I can see. Christina's with me, and we just drove down from St. Louis today, so we're particularly glad. Although there is a strange phenomenon when you cross the border, even out of Kentucky into Tennessee, everybody starts driving very strangely. We live in. Have you heard that? Well, it's true. It's not a lie. When we live in Maine, as Ann said, and we thought we knew bad driving, that it all came from Massachusetts. Well, that's actually not true. What I think I'll do is read you. These are four stories, novellas, if you like, and they all take place in 2012. after Hurricane Sandy in New Jersey, and just before Christmas, they're sort of Christmas stories in a sense by virtue of being set around that time. And they all have to do mostly with the consequences of that hurricane and the lives of people, and consequences that are probably those that would elude CNN and the New York Times. In other words, to some degree, they are made up consequences, which is what we all do when we find agency in things. We make it up. And they're told by Frank Bascom, and he is a realtor, or was, in central New Jersey. And so what I'll do is read you just the beginning story, not the whole story. I don't think you have time for that. As Ann said, I could have done with a minute. This is called I'm Here. Strange fragrances ride the twitchy, wintry air at the Jersey shore this morning, 2 weeks before Christmas. Flowery wreaths on an ominous sea stir expectancy in the unwary. It is, of course, the bouquet of large-scale home repair and rehab, fresh-cut lumber, clean white PVC, the lye sniff of sackcrete, stinging sealants, sweet tar paper and denatured spirits, the starchy zest of Tyvek mingled with the ocean's sulfurous weft and Barnegat Bay's landward stink. It is the air of full-on disaster. To my nose, once practiced in these things, nothing smells of ruin as fragrantly as the first attempts at rescue. I noticed it first at the red light at Hooper Avenue, and then again when I gas up my Sonata at the Hess station before heading to the bridge, Tom's River to Seaclift. Here, in the rich gas station scents, a wintry breeze flitters my hair while my dollars spool along like a slot machine in the gathering December clouds. Breeze has set the silver whirligigs to spinning at the grandly reopened Bed Bath and Beyond at the Ocean County Mall. Only new bedding can keep us down. Across its acres of parking, a tenth full at 10 a.m., the Home Depot, Kremlin-like, but enigmatically still your friend in spite of all, has thrown its doors open wide and early. Customers trail out, balancing boxes of new toilet works, new motherboards, new wiring harnesses, shrink-wrapped hinge assemblies, hollow core doors, an entire front stoop teetering on a giant shopping cart. All is on its way to some still-standing domicile blottoed by the hurricane 6 weeks past, but not lost from memory. Everyone still stunned here, quarrelsome, funked, put upon, but resolute. All are committed to coming back. Out here under the Hess awning, someone's piped in loud sports talk radio for us customers, the Pat and Mike show from Magic 107 in Trenton. I was once among their faithful. They're old now. A booming voice, it's Mike, declares, "Wow, we Patrick, Coach Ben Zawicki cut loose quite a hurricane of F-bombs, I'm telling you, a real 30 seconds over Tokyo." "Let's listen to it again," Pat says through a speaker built deep inside the gas pump. Total disbelief, total. This was on ESPN. Another gravelly, exhausted, recorded voice, Coach Ben Zawicki's, takes up in a fury. "Okay, let me just tell you so-called F-bomb sports writers one F-bomb thing, okay, you F-bombs. When you can F-bomb coach a team of 9-year-old F-bomb grammar school girls, then I might give you one shred of F-bomb respect. Until then, you F-bombs, you can double F-bomb yourselves. I'm here to F-bomb Sunday dinner. You heard it here first." The vacant-eyed, white-suited young Hess attendant who's pumping my gas hears nothing. He looks at me as if I wasn't here. "That about says it all, I guess," Mike concedes. "And then some," Pat concurs. "Just drop your keys on the desk, coach. You're done. Take the F-bomb bus back to F-bomb Chillicothe." Un-F-bomb believable. "Let's pause for a break, you F-bomb. Me, you're the F-bomb. Ha, ha, ha. Ha, 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 ha." In recent weeks, I've begun compiling a personal inventory of words that, in my view, should no longer be usable in speech or any form. This in the belief that life's a matter of gradual subtraction aimed at a solider, more nearly perfect essence after which all mentation goes and we head off to our virtual Chillicothes. A reserve of fewer, better words could help, I think, by setting an example for clearer thinking. It's not so different from moving to Prague and not learning the language so that the English you end up speaking to make yourself understood bears a special responsibility to be clear, simple, and value-bearing. When you grow old as I am, you pretty much live in the accumulations of life anyway. Not that much is happening except on the medical front. Better to strip things down. And where better to start stripping than the words we choose to express our increasingly rare, increasingly vagrant thoughts. It would be challenging, for instance, for a native Czech speaker to fully appreciate the words poop or friggin' or the phrase we're pregnant or what's the takeaway or for that matter awesome when it only means tolerable or preemie or mentee or legacy, or no problem when you really mean you're welcome. Likewise, soft landing, sibs, bond, hydrate when it just means drink, make art, share, reach out, noise used as a verb, and apropos of Magic 107, F-bomb. Fuck to me is still pretty serviceable as a noun, verb, or adjective with clear and distinct colorations to its already rich history. Language imitates the public riot, the poet said. And what's today's life like, if not a riot? Yesterday, just past 8, an unexpected phone call disrupted my morning. My wife, Sally, answered but got me out of bed to talk. I'd been lying awake in the early sunlight and shadows, daydreaming about the possibility that somewhere, somehow, some good thing was going on that would soon affect me and make me happy, only I didn't know it yet. Since I took leave of the real estate business after decades, anticipation of this kind is the thing I keenly miss, though it's the only thing, given how realty matters have gone and all that's happened to me. I am content here in Haddam, aged 68, enjoying the next level of life, conceivably the last. A member of the clean desk demographic, freed to do unalloyed good in the world, should I choose to. In that spirit, I travel once a week up to Newark Airport with a veterans group to greet the weary, puzzled, returning troopers home cycling in from Afghanistan and Iraq. I don't credit this as a commitment or a true giving back, since it's hardly inconvenient to stand smiling, hand outstretched, loudly declaring, "Welcome home, soldier or sailor or airman. Thank you for your service." It's more grandstanding than serious, and mostly meant to demonstrate that we're still relevant, and thus is guaranteed to prove we're not. In any case, my personal sensors are on alert for more than I can do that's positive with my end of day's time, known otherwise as retirement. The only reading material on my desk this morning is a copy of We Salute You, the publication we volunteers put into the hand of each Iraq and Afghanistan returnee the moment after we shake that hand and declare, "Welcome home, thank you for your service." We Salute You is a useful catch of vital information pertaining to anything the home leave soldier might need, want, or encounter in the first 6 hours stateside, assuming no one's meeting him or her, as surprisingly happens much of the time. We Salute You is printed by a cabal of right-wing Freedom Forum loonies out in Ohio who nonetheless manage to do a good job because they don't stuff our magazine with any of the gun control, anti-abortion, back to the Stone Age bullshit they do put in their regular anti-Obama mailings. I know because these publications came to my house until I made a complaint with the post office, after which they still came right through the election, though by now the crackpot Ohioans might have concluded their message didn't get through. We salute you is printed for each U.S. port of troop entry, L.A., New York, Newark, Boston, Houston, Seattle, even Detroit. It's 20 gray newsprint pages and online editions in the works, full of important phone numbers, email, and postal addresses for whatever geographical area the trooper or Marine or airman first puts a foot down on home soil. Panic attack, suicide, drug and alcohol abuse, helpline numbers are included. Veteran-friendly taxi companies, directions to transportation hubs, numbers to purchase a phone card, every church you can think of, including Muslims, Atheists, and Agnostics Anonymous. All these numbers are, of course, obtainable by anyone, though not in such an easy, free-of-charge, depoliticized format. There's also plenty of less expectable info, clean Vietnamese massage boutiques, outfitters for mule pack-ins in the Sierras, a clearinghouse for online sites to help you find a former girlfriend who's abandoned you, chat line numbers dealing with revenge issues, private phone numbers of all U.S. congressmen and senators, sites for how to buy Cuban cigars and condoms by the gross. There's an LGBT strength in numbers line, even a number for a Socrates Death Wish with Dignity support league, where psychologists with degrees from Oberlin and McAllister try to talk a soldier back from the brink while seeming to understand that death might seem the only option. Our mission, of course, occasionally fails. One young sailor from Piscataway, 3 days out of Kandahar, stuffed the exhaust pipes of his Trans Am with stolen copies of We Salute Yous and slipped the surly bonds in the Washington Crossing State Park parking lot. A note taped to the steering wheel saying, "Here's the future. Get ready for it." There's nothing you can do when someone's ready to go, though possibly a handshake didn't hurt. Late yesterday morning, my wife Sally came downstairs to where I was eating my all bran and stood staring, musing, through the window into the backyard at the late autumn squirrel activity. I was pleased to be thinking nothing worth recording, just breathing to the cadence of my chews. After a while of not speaking, she sat down across from me holding a book I'd noticed her reading late into the night. Her light stayed on after I'd gone to sleep, then was switched off, then on again. It's not unusual for people our age. "I read this shocking thing last night." She held the book she'd been engrossed by, clutched to her yoga shirt. Her eyes were intent. She seemed worried. I couldn't make out the book's spine, but understood she meant to tell me about it. "Tell me," I said. "Well," she pursed her lips, "back in 1862, right when the Civil War was in full swing, the U.S. cavalry had time to put down an Indian revolt in Minnesota. Did you know that?" "I did," I said. "The Dakota Uprising. It's pretty famous." "Okay, you know about it." "I didn't." "I know some things," I said, and stared down at a banana slice. "Okay, but..." "In December of 1862, our government hanged 38 Sioux warriors on one big scaffold, just did it all at once." "That's famous, too," I said. "Supposedly that massacred 800 white people, not that that's an excuse." Sally took in a breath and turned her head away in a manner to indicate a tear she didn't want seen might be wobbling out of her eyes. "But do you know what they said?" These words were nearly choked with throat-clogging emotion. "What who said?" "The Indians. They all began shouting out as they were standing on the gallows waiting to drop and never speak again." I didn't know, but I looked up to let her understand. I realized this was important to her and that the next thing she said would be important to me. Possibly my spoon had paused on its upward arc toward my mouth. I may have shaken my head in amazement. "They all shouted, 'I'm here.' They started calling that out in their Sioux language all around that awful contraption that was about to kill them. People who heard it said it was awe-inspiring, not awesome. No one ever forgot it. Then they hanged them, all of them, at one moment. 'I'm here.' As if that made it all right for them, made death tolerable and less awful. It gave them strength. Sally shook her head. Her tear of anguish for long ago, 1862, did not emerge. She held her book tight to her front and smiled at me mournfully across the glass-topped table where I've eaten possibly 3,000 breakfasts. I just thought you'd want to know about that. I'm sorry to ruin your breakfast. I'm glad to know about it, sweetheart, I said. It didn't ruin my breakfast at all. I'm here, she said, and seemed to embarrass herself. So am I said. And with those words, she got up, came around the square table, kissed me once on my forehead, still embarrassed, then went away, carrying her book back to where she'd come from in our house. Well, that's one little passage of this book. Thank you. Thank you very much. I think if you will let me, I'll read another little passage to you. I know that's a false thing to say. No one's going to say, shit, go away. Isn't that enough? Does he never stop? As I said, this is, maybe I didn't say, but I should have said, this is a book which I understood after I had written all four stories, was a book about bearing witness. And I never really knew what bearing witness meant. You hear Christians talk about bearing witness and testifying and things like that. I just thought, because I'm not a Christian, that it was something I didn't understand. But I wrote these stories as one does, somewhat uncalculatedly, somewhat spontaneously, with a sense that they fitted together in some way. And what I came to understand about them was that what unified them was bearing witness, which meant, I learned to me, giving yourself to someone else in order that your presence will affirm theirs, or that in better circumstances, giving yourself to someone in order that your presence will make their presence better if they are ill or if they are in despair, or if they are somehow in need of someone else just to be there. And that's what these stories are about, sort of mirabile dictu. I didn't know that was what they were going to be, but they are, and I'm glad. You know, it's always wonderful when you write a book and you get to the end and it kind of seems to hang together. You think it will, you hope it will, but you need some luck. As Anne will tell you, you need some luck. Being there is a help, but you need some luck. This is a story called The New Normal, and it involves Frank going to see his ex-wife of 30 years, who has, against his wishes, moved very close to live by him, just when she discovers that she has Parkinson's disease and moves into a very fancy elder care facility, and she asks him a favor, which he doesn't want to perform, of course. And he goes out to see her. And I'll read you just the beginning of this story. It's called The New Normal. It takes place in the New Jersey suburbs outside of a town called Haddam, New Jersey, just before Christmas. Out the Haddam Great Road, just past 5, freezing rain has turned the blacktop into after-hours dodge-em cars. Only a few of us are braving it, our headlights glaring off the pavement like sheeny Novas. A Ford Explorer. Why is it always a Ford Explorer? It's already gone in the ditch, its driver waving me on with a shrug. A wrecker's on its way. Off in the trees on both sides, immense manorial houses twinkle through. Yuletide spruces framed in picture windows blaze outward, sharing Christmas cheer with the less moneyed. Years ago, I drove out here on just such a gloomy wintry night to stand and hand-deliver a $2 million full-price offer on a slant-roof architect-designed monstrosity that's long since been torn down and calamitously hit a dog, precisely next door to the house I was hoping to sell. As with the Explorer, I went straight in the ditch, but clambered out, up, and across the black ice road to help, to bring whatever helpless help I could to the poor wrecked beast who'd made a whomp when I hit it boding ill. I, of course, feared it was my client's dog. There the poor thing lay in the ice-crusted grass in front of number 2605, breathing deep, rasping, not long for this world breaths, its sorrowing eyes resigned and open to the snowy night, its last, not offering to move or even to notice me beside it on my knees, my cold hand on its hairy, hard ribs, feeling them rise and fall, It was a hound, a black and tan, somebody's old love bug, a wiggly crotch sniffer and shoe muncher, bought for the kids, yet still surviving on after they'd gone, and prime now to be hit. What can I do for you, old Towser? I said these absurd words, knowing their answer. Nothing, thanks. You've done enough. After minutes, I hiked up to the house I was selling, shamefaced and in shock. I informed my clients what I'd terribly done. We all three walked down to the road in the snow, but the old boy had passed beyond us and was, because it was damn cold, grown stiff and peaceful and perfect. They didn't know whose dog it was. A hunter's strayed away in the night, they thought, though it was past the season for that. My clients, the Armentes, long since beyond life's pale themselves, felt a sorrow for me and my plight and let me go home with the promise to do something about the dog in the morning. I shouldn't worry. It was a terrible night out, which it was. In my realtor's memory, they accepted the offer following some testy back and forths with the young Bengali buyers. I often recollect such matters more positively than was true. It was a long time ago, 20 years at least. The dog, of course, lives on. I am on my pilgrim's way tonight. It's only 5:10, but could easily be midnight, to visit my former wife, Ann Dykstra, a resident now in the Beth Wessel wing at the community at Carnage Hill, a state-of-the-art staged care facility out here in what was once, when we were married 40 years ago, the verdant Haddam hinterlands. The community today borders a Robert Trent Jones faux links course hidden from the road by a swatch of woods, the leaves now down. A birchbark canoe institute sits off to the left in deeper timber, its lights busily yellowing the snow-flittery night. Other grand houses are semi-visible, accessible by gates with uniformed protection. Once it was possible to cast my eye over almost any piece of settled landscape here around and know how it would look in the future. What uses it'd be set to by succeeding waves of human purpose, as if a logic lay buried within the genome of its later what's-it. Though out here now, all is frankly enigma. Probably it's my age, which explains more and more about me like a master decryption code. In New Jersey, we've now built to the edge of the last 1,000,000 acres of remotely developable land. We're on track to use it up by mid-century. Property taxes are capped, but no one wants to sell, since no one wants to buy, all of which keeps prices high, but values low. My mission into the night's sinister weather 4 days before Christmas is to deliver to Anne a special yoga-approved, form-fitted, densely foamed and molded orthopedic pillow, which she can sleep on, and that's recommended by neurologists in Switzerland to homeopathically treat Parkinson's, of which she's a new sufferer, by reducing stress levels associated with poor sleep, which themselves are associated with neck pain, which is associated with two vivid dreams, all associated with Parkinson's. Anne has resided in the Beth Wessel, able-bodied, independent wing since last June. She has her own two-bedroom, feng shui-approved apartment, does her own cooking, drives her own Focus, and has even acquired a boyfriend, a former Philadelphia cop named Buck. He has a last name, but I can't pronounce it since it's Polish. Buck's a large, dull piece of cordwood in his 70s, given to loose-fitting, permanently belted trousers, matching beige sweatshirts of the kind sold at Kmart, big galunker, imitation suede shoes, and the thinnest of thin, pale hosiery. Some where someone convinced Buck that a sculpted imperial and a pair of black horn-rimmed Dave Garraway specs would make him look less like a Polish meatball and make people take him more seriously, which probably never happens, though he's officially on record as handsome. He could pass as the good cop who genially interrogates the poor black kid from the projects until he suddenly loses his temper, bulges his eyes, balls up his horseshoe fists in the kid's face, and scares the shit out of him. Buck's carrying around a different John Grisham book every time I see him and refers to himself only as a first responder. I regularly encounter him lurking in the big public room he doesn't have enough to do with no robberies and home invasion to get his mitts into. He likes the idea that Anne, who he infuriatingly calls Miss Annie, that Anne and I go way back, which isn't quite the word for it. And that he and I share private, implicitly sexual understandings about her that men such as we are would never speak about, but that in the aggregate are special, possibly symbolic, and render us both lucky to have lived this long foot soldiers in Miss Annie's army. Like me, Buck's a prostate survivor, and his personal talk is the sort that would drive Anne straight to the rafters. It includes his rank disdain for Viagra. No need for that junk. I prize my stiffy, let me tell you. The existence of a horse pill obtainable online that makes us prostate guys piss like Percherons, thereby avoiding the men's room blues. Needless to say, he doesn't like Obama and blames him for shit-canning the American dream by creating a lost decade when it came to little people keeping up. He's a nice enough guy, meaning the president, but he wasn't ready to assume the mantle. Bush, of course, was ready. And I'm convinced, spends time with him only to display for me the limitless variety of Homo sapiens who can easily fill my long empty shoes. Though why should affairs of his heart and hers be less scrutable than the affairs of my own? It's not, however, the simplest of emotional transits to be driving out 4 days before Christmas to visit my ex-wife. We've been divorced 30 years in an extended care facility, suffering an incurable and fatal disease, and with whom I've not been all that friendly, but who's now a 20-minute drive away and somehow or other presenting issues. Relations end nowhere, as the poet said. How Ann Dykstra came to reside 20 minutes from my doorstep is a bittersweet tale of our time and should serve as cautionary if one's long ex-wife constitutes a demographic possible to comprehend and thus beware of. When Ann retired off the athletic faculty at de Tocqueville Academy, she'd begun keeping time but expecting nothing serious with one of her de Tocqueville colleagues, the lumbering, swarthy-skinned, curly-haired ex-Harvard math whiz and lifelong mother's boy, Teddy Fuchs. Years before, Teddy had been headed for celestial math greatness, but had suffered a dissociative episode on the eve of his thesis defense on rectilinear quadratic equations and been banished to prep school teaching at de Tocqueville, a not long drive from where his parents lived on the shore in Belmar. At de Tocqueville, Teddy was regarded by all as profound and gentle and what else, super bright, and as having this special connection with kids, which persuaded everybody that prep school teaching was his true métier, rather than being a chaired professor at Caltech with a clear shot at a Nobel, but possibly never being really, really happy like the rest of high school teachers. Teddy, at age 60, had never married, but had avoided the standard smirks and yorks and back-channel eye-rollings about his sexuality by being benign. There were no rumors of Greenwich Village adieu sightings or mysterious friends brought to faculty cookouts. Some people really are what they seem, though not that many. Teddy and Anne began seeing each other, began being a couple, taking trips, Turks and Caicos, Tel Aviv, the Black Sea port of Odessa, and speaking exclusively in terms of the other. I'll have to ask Anne about that. You know, back when Teddy was at Harvard, and as a tea time, Teddy wrote an influential paper about that his junior year, which caused a lot of stir. These are mostly things she would never have said about me, since flogging suburban houses on cul-de-sacs that once were cornfields in West Windsor, New Jersey, rarely gets you noticed by the folks at the Stanford Linear Accelerator. I know any of this because our daughter Clarissa Bascom, now a veterinarian in Scottsdale, told me. Clarissa has always kept semi-taut lines with her mother, though much tauter with me and her brother. Back when it was all getting started with Teddy, Clarissa believed her mom could tolerate only a platonic relationship and that there was neither hanky nor panky afoot, that Teddy, though large, levantine, hairy, and apparently sensual, was in fact harmless and remote from his body. Lesbians think they know everything. And that after Anne's two marriages to two unsatisfactory men, one of them me, being with a man like Teddy, thoughtful, hopelessly reliable, obedient, occasionally mirthful, but not that much, no bad history with women, a good cook, and most important, Jewish, guaranteeing, Clarissa believed, no unwanted sexual advances, Teddy was all but perfect. Like most explanations, it's as plausible as anything else. Plus, Clarissa liked Teddy. I only met him twice by accident. They had Harvard in common, and for all I know, sat up late nights singing the fucking songs. Long story short, it's never short enough. Anne retired and so did Teddy, whose mother had conveniently died at age 90. Anne had dough from her second marriage. Teddy had his dead parents' 3,000-square-foot condo overlooking the sea in Belmar. A charmed coming together, it seemed, was forged for both parties, an acquaintance that hesitantly blossomed into something more instead of the usual less, a mutually acknowledged, if somewhat not fully shared, sense of life's being better when not spent dismally alone, a willingness to try to take an interest in the other, learn golf, learn calculus, plus the condo. Anne and Teddy sent around at-home announcements. One actually came to me, declaring the uniting of all our assets, real, spiritual, and virtual. I took note, but not serious note. As far as I was concerned, Anne had simply embarked on another new course in life, the main source of interest and primary selling point of which was that it carried her further away from being my wife and nearer to becoming just another person I might never have known, whose obituary my eye might pass over without the slightest pause or twinge, which is the goal and most perfect paradigm of what we mean when we say divorce. Though, of course, that's crazy. The kids see to it, as does memory, which, short of Alzheimer's, never lets you off the mat. Thank you. I was saying to Christina today when we were driving, I said, you know, I'm obviously not Frank Bascom. Well, maybe it's not obvious to you, but I'm not. And I think sometimes he says some interesting things. He says some unacceptable things, and I sometimes think that I get credit for it. I don't want credit for it. I think the more important thing that a writer can do is not write about himself or herself, but to make something that is apart from you, that you can be completely free in imagining and put into things you could not put into yourself if you were writing about yourself, because yourself wouldn't represent that. So for me, Frank Bascom, even though we share some interests, are not particularly consonant in our views. If anybody has a question, I'll be happy to try to. Yes, sir.
So you're not Frank Bascom? No. You're not Frank?
No, I'm not.
I'm wondering about the Ford Explorer in the ditch.
Yeah.
Is that intended as a metaphor for another exploring Ford?
You're reading much too closely. Am I in the ditch? I might be in the ditch. Well, you know, it's the only place worth going when you're a novelist. Just go in the ditch and see how you can get yourself out. Yeah, yeah. No, that was just, that was really just the residue of once owning a Ford Explorer. And when you drive down, you know, where we live, it's icy. And I remember one time I was driving from New Orleans to was driving from New Orleans to Northwestern, where I was teaching a course, and right up 55, and cars were in the ditch, and it was always Ford Explorers. That was 20 years ago. So it never, you know, good novelists never forget anything. If I saw it, I remember it. Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
I wondered
what drew me to New Jersey. Well, I had kind of gone in the ditch as a novelist in 1981, and I'd written two books and nobody had read them, and I thought I'd pretty much had my shot, and that I needed to go out and get an honest job. So I got a job as a sports writer, and I didn't move to New York. We were living in New Jersey. We were living in Princeton. And I went up and worked a couple of years at this sports magazine, and then it went in the ditch. And I came back down to Princeton, and I didn't have anything to do. I wasn't prepared to do anything. I didn't have any skills. I'd written two novels. I was 37 years old. And I thought, well, what can I do? What do I do with myself down here? So I thought I'd write a novel, and I sort of looked around, and I thought, well, what do I know anything about? I mean, I'm a Mississippian, but I'd long ago realized that they didn't need to be another one of us. They'd already, the people who had gone before me had already done very well. So I thought, well, find some new place that you can write about, that you can be the world's greatest expert in, if only because nobody had written about the suburbs of New Jersey. Roth had written about Newark and those places in New York, and nobody that I knew had written about the suburbs. And so I thought, well, write about the suburbs because you really do know a lot about it. We lived there for a while at that point. And I thought, well, you know, what do you do when you write about the suburbs? Well, generally people think that New Jersey is a terrible place, as you know, because you're from there. And it's not. It's not. It's not at all. It's a really great place. No. Moreover, it's not just a great place, but it's also a microcosm of the United States in a way. It's got all of these geographical features that can be found in Wyoming, and can be found in the South. It's got the shore. Got these huge river valleys. Got the little mountains. It's got a big. You know, it's got everything. So I thought, instead of saying, you know, boo hoo hoo about the suburbs, I would write a paean to the suburbs. I would write one novel, which is all I thought I'd write, which would be kind of a celebration of life there and how real sensate life can occur there. So that's why. Yes, ma'am.
I have a quick comment and a question.
Okay.
A quick comment is that I told a good friend in Chicago that I was going to come to hear you.
Uh-huh.
And so
I was last year.
And so I just thought you might want to pass that on to whoever markets you.
My wife is here, so just to be.
Well,
we can kind of keep that level.
Would you just talk about
Well, I've never thought that when you say if the pursuit of human happiness is relevant, I know what you mean when you say that. I generally think, you know, what we mostly mean by happy is an ice cream cone on a hot Saturday afternoon, or going to the circus or something like that. And to me, those are great things for children. And there may be sometimes great things for adults, too. So as far as I'm concerned, one has to define happiness for oneself, and it may not be that kind of jubilation. It may not be that kind of exaltation. It may mean a number of things. It may mean, are you making yourself useful to others? It may mean, are you doing the best you can at something? Are you doing what you want to be doing? It's a whole menu of possible things. And if you will let me understand happiness in that way, then I would say yes. It's still a very relevant idea. When I started writing The Sports Writer, I had written two books in which the conceit was that darkness for its own sake is per se dramatic and interesting. And I don't think that's true now, and I don't know that I thought it was true then. But Christina said to me, she said, "Why don't you write a novel about somebody who's happy? Never done that before." And so I thought, how would I do that? How would I make a person who's happy interesting? Apropos of Tolstoy, that happy families are all alike, which is of course not true. So I thought, well, what I would do is I would write a novel about somebody who was in despair and who was trying to find the vocabulary and the psychic means and the circumstances to make himself better, to make himself less in that particular despondency. So that's how I define happiness. So I think it's always the case that happiness is a condition that we define for ourselves singly. Thank you. Anything else that I can say? Yes, ma'am.
Can you comment on where your voice comes for men and women? You have this extraordinary capacity to sort of keep it at bay, pull them together, dissect the feeling. And you do, I think the way you portray women and how women feel is,
I wish I could bring you with me every place I go.
It's that how people did it just in the story. I mean, why is she, there so she can get the pillow?
Yes.
Talk about the neurology pillow.
Yes.
I'm a neurologist.
I see.
Where does that voice come from?
Well, I wouldn't know if it's evolving. I just try to write the book I'm writing, and not look back at the books that I have written to see how it's different. I think in my set of values, I'm always trying to get better at what I do, without a literal sense of comparing what I'm doing now to what I did do. I just think to myself, well, the last book that I wrote that I thought was as good as I could write was a sort of entree to let me do this. And so I think if I work at it as hard as I can, I'll be better at it. I'll make it better, just ipso facto. I can say a lot of things in answer to that, but the thing that I think that's most important to me is that in fiction, I mean, I know that there are women and there are men, and that you can't generalize about women and you can't generalize about men. Women aren't typically this way or typically that way. Men aren't that either. Women aren't more forgiving and more nurturing. Men aren't always silent and brooding and don't express themselves. Sometimes they are. So what I'm mostly doing is trying to make two distinct creatures on the page. One might be a woman and one might be a man, but I never think that I'm making what you might call gender distinctions, because I wouldn't know how to make them. I wouldn't know how a woman per se sounds. I only know how this person can sound and how I make that person sound. And if that's a woman, then that turns out to be a woman. But sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's another man. Sometimes it's a child. Sometimes it's an adolescent, sometimes it's a 20-year-old. So it's much less a matter for me of distinguishing between genders than it is trying to make two distinct characters come together in a way that has torque in it. And that can happen between any two people or among any three. So it's not about women and men with me, it's about people. And indeed, from a slightly more lofty sort of position, ontological position. What literature does, if it can, is to try to show us how we are alike more than it tries to show us how we are distinct and unreconcilable. Thank you all. You're very kind.